This is Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics, a serialized audiobook addressing the intersections of pedagogy and power in our connected and challenging education environment. It's the audio version of the open access collection of the same name, published in February 2021. The book features 27 chapters of provocative text addressing the intersections of critical pedagogy and digital technology in our present political moment. I'm your host, Chris Friend, from Kane University. I introduce your authors and read the occasional chapter. This podcast provides one more avenue for accessing the material from the book, which is also available as an ebook, a print-on-demand paperback, a series of articles published on the open web, and screen and print-ready PDFs available for free on Hybrid Pedagogy. This is Chapter 4 of Part 3 Politics, and you'll hear Pedagogy and the Logic of Platforms, originally published in EDUCAUSE Review on the 3rd of July, 2017. The original work is licensed Creative Commons Attribution Non-Derivative and appears in Hybrid Teaching with permission of the author, Chris Gilliard. This chapter opens with a block quote from Nelson, 1987. Computers are just as oppressive as before, but smaller and cheaper and more widespread. Now you can be oppressed by computers in your living room. In his initial New Horizons column in EDUCAUSE Review, Mike Caulfield asked, "Can higher education save the web?" I was intrigued by this question because I often say to my students that the web is broken and that the ideal thing to do, although quite unrealistic, would be to tear it down and start from scratch. I call the web broken because its primary architecture is based on what Harvard Business School professor Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, a form of information capitalism that aims to protect and modify human behavior as a means to produce revenue and market control. Web 2.0, the web of platforms, personalization, clickbait, and filter bubbles, is the only web most students know. That web exists by extracting individuals' data through persistent surveillance, data mining, tracking, and browser fingerprinting, and then seeking new and quote-unquote innovative ways to monetize that data. As platforms and advertisers seek to perfect these strategies, colleges and universities rush to mimic those strategies in order to improve retention. That said, I admit it might be useful to search for a more suitable term than broken. The web is not broken in this regard. A web based on surveillance, personalization, and monetization works perfectly well for particular constituencies, but it doesn't work quite as well for persons of color, lower-income students, and people who have been walled off from information or opportunities because of the way they are categorized according to opaque algorithms. My students and I frame the realities of the current web in the context of digital redlining, which provides the basis for understanding how and why the web works the way it does and for whom. The concept of digital redlining springs from an understanding of the historical policy of redlining. A quote here from the Fair Housing Center of Greater Boston: "The practice of denying or limiting financial services to certain neighborhoods based on racial or ethnic composition without regard to the residents' qualifications or creditworthiness. The term redlining refers to the practice of using a red line on a map to delineate the area where financial institutions would not invest." In the United States, redlining began informally but was institutionalized in the National Housing Act of 1934. At the behest of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, the Homeowners Loan Corporation created maps for America's largest cities and color-coded the areas where loans would be differentially available. The difference among these areas was race. Digital redlining is the modern equivalent of this historical form of societal division. It is the creation and maintenance of technological policies, practices, pedagogy, and investment decisions that enforce class boundaries and discriminate against specific groups. The digital divide is a noun. It is the consequence of many forces. In contrast, digital redlining is a verb, the doing of difference, a doing whose consequences reinforce existing class structures. In one era, redlining created differences in physical access to schools, libraries, and home ownership. In my classes, we work to recognize how digital redlining is integrated into technologies, and especially education technologies, and is producing similar kinds of discriminatory results. We might think about digital redlining as the process by which different schools get differential journal access. If one of the problems of the web as we know it now is access to quality information, digital redlining is the process by which so much of that quality information is locked by paywalls that prevent students and learners of all kinds from accessing that information. We might think about digital redlining as the level of surveillance in the form of analytics that predict grades or programs that suggest majors to students. We might also think about digital redlining to the degree that students who perform Google searches get certain information based on the type of machine they are using, or get served ads for high-interest loans based on their digital profile, a practice Google now bans. It's essential to note that the personalized nature of the web often dictates what kind of information students get both inside and outside the classroom. A Data and Society Research Institute study makes this clear. Quote, "In an age of smartphones and social media, young people don't follow the news as much as it follows them. News consumption is often a byproduct of spending time on social media platforms. When it comes to getting news content, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and native apps like the Apple News app are currently the most common places where the teens and young adults encounter news." Students are often surprised and even angered to learn the degree to which they are digitally redlined, surveilled, and profiled on the web, and to find out that educational systems are looking to replicate many of these worst practices in the name of efficiency, engagement, or improved outcomes. Students don't know any other web, or for that matter, have any notion of a web that would be different from the one we have now. Many teachers have at least heard about a web that didn't spy on users, a web that was, theoretically at least, about connecting not through platforms, but through interfaces where individuals had a significant amount of choice in saying how the web looked and what was shared. A big part of the teaching that I do is to tell students it's not supposed to be like this, or it doesn't have to be like this. The web is fraught with recommender engines and analytics. Colleges and universities buy information on prospective students, and institutions profile students through social media accounts. Prospective employers do the same. When students find out about micro-targeting, social media filter bubbles, surveillance capitalism, facial recognition, and black box algorithms making decisions about their future, and learn that because so much targeting is based on economics and race, it will disproportionately affect them, their concept of what the web is changes. Another aspect of my teaching is rethinking the notion of consent. It's important to ask, what would the web look like if surveillance capitalism, information asymmetry, and digital redlining were not at the root of most of what students do online? We don't know the answer. But if higher education is to save the web, we need to let students envision that something else is possible, and we need to enact those practices in classrooms. To do that, we need to understand consent to mean more than click here if you agree to these terms. I often wonder if it's possible to have this discussion without engaging in a deep and ahistorical practice of nostalgia. Telling students about the good old days of hand coding and dial-up internet access probably isn't the best way to spend classroom time. However, when we use the web now, when we use it with students, and when we ask students to engage online, we must always ask, what are we signing them up for? Ultimately, we must get them to ask that question themselves and take it with them. Here, the term consent, often overused and misunderstood, needs to be foregrounded in the idea that we must do all we can to explore the reality that students are entering into an asymmetrical relationship with platforms. While we can do our best to inform students, the black box nature of the web means that we can never definitively say to them, this is what you are going to be a part of. The fact that the web functions the way it does is illustrative of the tremendously powerful economic forces that structure it. Technology platforms like Facebook and Twitter, and education technologies like the learning management system, exist to capture and monetize data. Using higher education to save the web means leveraging the classroom to make visible the effects of surveillance capitalism. It means more clearly defining and empowering the notion of consent. Most of all, it means envisioning, with students, new ways to exist online. That was Pedagogy and the Logic of Platforms, originally published in EduCause Review on the 3rd of July, 2017. The original work is licensed Creative Commons Attribution Non-Derivative and appears in Hybrid Teaching with permission of the author, Chris Gilliard. Chris is a writer, professor, and speaker. His scholarship concentrates on digital privacy, surveillance, and the intersections of race, class, and technology. He is an advocate for critical and equity-focused approaches to tech in education. Well, that's it for this episode. Next time, you'll hear Disowning Tech by Timothy R. Amidon. This serialized audiobook version of Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics is available wherever you find podcasts. I'm Chris Friend, collection editor, podcast producer, and host. I tweet at Chris_Friend and teach at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. The theme music for this project is Where Was I? From Lee Rosevere. That song, as well as the text and audio of Hybrid Teaching, are all licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, which means they can be reused with author acknowledgement. Licenses like these make multimedia works like this simpler to create, and I'm especially grateful to each of the authors for allowing their material to be reused in this format. And I'm also grateful to you. Thanks for listening.